This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, today I get to travel. At the bottom of the hour, I will be traveling to France, where Jillian Harvey will take me to a farmhouse, and it's going to be lots of fun to travel with her down there. But now I get to go, to Hollywood. Well, this is so exciting. Robert Crace is a Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster, and I am so honored, really, to have you back on the program again, Bob. You are fantastic, and the new book is really, really great.
Thank you, Patsy. Welcome to Los Angeles.
Oh, well, you know, there's only one reason I would come to West Hollywood is if the films that I wrote and were optioned and appeared in the Hollywood Reporter, if they were suddenly taken out of turnaround, I would rush to Hollywood. But it is wonderful that I get to go there vicariously with you, because you take us, really. You are the L.A. Hollywood writer.
Well, Los Angeles and Hollywood is very much though it's a setting of my books, it's very much a character in the story. I don't think Elvis Cole, my detective, could exist as he does in any other city in America. Los Angeles is a place for dreamers, and I think that's what Elvis, in a way, helps people does through his detective work. He helps people realize their dreams.
And with this new book, of course, it's called Racing the Light. And I love it. First of all, I love any book where within the first few pages, there's a little bit of Latin. So you threw in some Latin there. You know, this is from 4 years of studying Latin, my best subject in school. I always love that. But there are so many wonderful things that you have a way with words that is so much fun. I've never seen it written down before. A school of cars. Everything you write is so perfect for the scene that you're setting.
I appreciate that so much. I try to be evocative in my language. I write detective novels, so they're a mix of thriller elements, emotional elements, humorous elements. So as I write the scenes, I do try to use very precise language in order to suggest an emotion to the reader. And I think these phrases help things like that.
It does, because after I read that, I mean, it's just a little bit, you know? And yet once I read that, I thought, yes, it's been 25 years since I drove on the streets of Los Angeles. But thinking about it, it is like a school nowadays, of course, because everybody's always in a rush, a school of sharks. Very
That's
aggressive.
True. Listen, I love living in Los Angeles, but I have to tell you, Patsy, I hate the traffic. Oh. I just hate the traffic. We have the worst.
It's unbelievable. I mean, that was 25 years ago. And then people were a little bit milder. I mean, they were not quite as aggressive, I think. So then it might have been a school of fish, but now they are definitely a school of sharks. And the way you wrote that right there, just that little, you know, three words, and you set the scene. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Well, you are, of course, it's 3 years since I mean, we've been waiting a long time. I think you're on that list of, the 10 most wanted books for 2022. Everybody's been waiting for this new book, and people will not be disappointed, because this is a wonderful story. you have all our favorite characters back in there, and they're all just doing it's wonderful. And what I like, you know, again, you write about a man, his name is Josh, and you write about him being in a coffee shop, and when I got to the part where I realized that Josh stood up for the woman who was coming in to meet him, and I thought, but just knowing that he was the kind of person who would stand up for her coming in, and then this whole story unravels there as we find out that she's got a mystery and she's presenting it to Josh. Explain who Josh is and why somebody would want to give him some very secret information.
You know, as you just said, it's been 3 years since my last book, which was A Dangerous Man. And when A Dangerous Man was published 3 years ago, I was already at work on what was to be the following Elvis Cole novel. But not long after A Dangerous Man was published is when COVID came to the country and the pandemic broke out and all the chaos and insanity that followed. You know, suddenly we all woke up, and it was like we had awoken in some terrible dystopian science fiction movie, right? And we're watching TV every day, and we're getting you know, the news is conflicted and contrary, and there's all these multiple stories about the source of the virus, and in the early days, even if like, are we all going to die? I mean, it was crazy. And I found myself, you know, I have writer friends who, when the lockdowns started and no one could leave their homes and whatnot, I had some writer friends who said, oh my gosh, I have so much free time now, I'm going to write 2-3 books a year. For me, it was just the opposite. I just was totally derailed from the book I was writing. And I was just glued to the TV with this sort of obsessive watching of the numbers and the news reports. And by the numbers, I mean, you know, the number of people dying and the number of people being hospitalized and all these nightmare news items. And I actually grew angry with the news reports because they were in such conflict with each other. I didn't know what to believe or which news reader to trust, and you know, what is real here, and that really brought home to me the importance of being able to trust what you're told, the importance of the awareness that someone here is lying and someone here is keeping secrets, but who? And the more I began to think about that, and I did try to get back to that earlier book, but I just couldn't reconnect in it. But so the more I became obsessed with truth, I ended up creating Josh Schumacher, the character you mentioned. And Josh Schumacher is a young podcaster who's given to conspiracy theories and fringe type topics, you know, Area 51 and all these things. So he's dismissed by society at large, and he's dismissed by his own parents who think he's thrown his life away, etc. But for me, Josh became my hero because he through this young woman he meets in the opening scene, he stumbles upon a true story, an actual story of an enormous crime happening in Los Angeles. And when Josh learns of it, he commits himself fully and completely to uncovering the truth and exposing the bad guys. And at that moment, I knew here's Josh Schumacher, would be a warrior for justice. And it just seemed natural to me to pair him up with my detective, Elvis Cole, and we could see what unfolded together.
And you certainly you have a plenty to unfold, because there are so many layers to this mystery, starting with Josh's mother and everyone else around him. I love the way you unfold a story. And of course, when you bring in Joe Pike, all of your readers are like, "Oh, Joe's here."
He has a lot of. He's very popular with my readers. Yes.
Oh, I know. People go around saying, "Oh, Joe Pike needs his own book." Joe Pike. People love Joe Pike.
You used the word layer. You use the word layers, and I think that's appropriate and right here. Because, you know, with the type of a crime novel that I write, where there is a mystery within a mystery within a mystery, Elvis Cole, the detective, he has to peel back the layers of the onion to get to the next level of truth. Only when he gets there, he's unsure, is this really true, or are there more layers to peel back? So it's my job as the writer to have Elvis uncover those layers little by little, and hopefully I do so with enough energy to the story that it keeps people turning pages.
Definitely there's enough energy, and as I said, the way that you are able to put in all of these little, a few words here and there that keep us just intrigued and take us to the location. Of course, nobody does Los Angeles better than you. Nobody. The minute I saw the word bungalow, I said, "Oh yes, oh yes." Isn't that a wonderful word? And it's funny, you know, I live here in Florida, and we have a lot of bungalows around here. Yet nobody has ever used that word around here, and I love that word.
Oh, I do too, and I love bungalow. Well, I'm originally from Louisiana.
I think we all know that. You were born in one L.A., and
there,
then you moved
to... But when I got to Los Angeles, I learned about bungalows for the first time and saw them and actually fell in love with them because they're very charming and cute, and I always thought they make wonderful settings for my character, so I use them. Local color.
They do, and it's just it's evocative of not just the look of the bungalow, but also it takes us back very much to the 1930s films and all of that that I know made a great influence on your writing.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I grew up on those things. So they were part of the original engine that influenced me. And though I write differently today, you know, the Elvis Cole novels are, of course, set in the here and now, and they're very modern. But at the same time, the shadows of those past things are clearly evident in my work.
Oh, yeah. Chandler is always like a little bit sitting there on your shoulder, I think.
I think so. I mean, of course. You know, the interesting thing about people who write detective fiction is that the lineage is very clear. You know, everyone currently writing detective fiction today, or frankly, cop fiction, or any of these sort of investigators, owes a thanks to the original masters of this, whether we're talking Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett or Ross Thomas, or even the writers the little-known writers who came before them. Because, you know, one generation reads the prior generation, and then they're somehow influenced, and they pass it on to later generations. So it's a trickle-down effect that is evident in everyone's work, I believe.
Well, I think if I wrote mysteries, Dorothy Sayers would be sitting on my shoulder because I would use Latin.
Sure, there you go.
You know, that's what I always love. That's why I got such a kick out of you having a little bit of Latin, because you don't see it that often, and it's just fun.
Well, I was just showing off, Patsy. That's all there is to it.
Well, I don't know. As I said, that was my favorite subject. The reason it was my favorite subject in school was by the time I was in high school, I got to high school, I'd already read thousands of books. I was reading, like, Camus, and I was reading very advanced books. I'd already gone through Tolstoy and Dostoevsky by the time I got to high school. So you can imagine that it was pretty dull for me, other than chemistry, which I loved because I could make all sorts of fun experiments. And I was always hanging out with the boys and making smoke, stink bombs and stuff like that. And then Latin, because I didn't know it, and it was difficult. So what was your favorite subject? Because it's interesting that you didn't go to school to study writing. You went to school to study mechanical engineering.
Yeah, where I'm from, to become a writer was simply unheard of. You know, people did real things, and when you went to school, you were supposed to study a subject that led to a job, as opposed to something more esoteric like writing or acting or these sort of things. So, you know, from early on, I was sort of guided toward becoming an engineer. So that's what I studied in school. But you know, the fact of the matter is, I had always wanted to be a writer. It just wasn't encouraged. I had wanted to be a writer and had begun writing small short stories as early as junior high. I like to say I was a closet writer because no one knew what I was doing. But I did. I studied a lot of mathematics and physics and chemistry and engineering in school. Absolutely none of it prepared me to be a writer. But the part-time writing I was doing and the enormous amount of reading I was doing, all that was my preparation for becoming a writer. And then very early 20s, when the short stories I was writing began to sell, that was my first indicator that I actually might be able to make a living doing this. So I quit school and I left Louisiana behind and I moved to Los Angeles to get into television, and did.
Well, you know, it's November, which is National Novel Writing Month, and so many of my listeners are actually writing for the first time. They've decided to, you know, finally settle down and write a book. When you talk about reading, this is so important. I always recommend to, you know, to people who ask me, just like, you know, every writer, real writer, knows that reading is so important. And so often nowadays, people come to it because they haven't read enough. And so you say you read a lot when you were young. What were your biggest influences? Not just the mystery writers, but other authors, European authors. Did you like English authors, Dickens? Who were your authors that really impressed you and helped you to grow as a writer?
Early in my development, I'd have to say writers like Ernest Hemingway, who I still reread. Especially his short stories, but also his shorter novels. The Old Man and the Sea, I probably read, to say, 15 times. I was also heavily, at one point in my development, I was heavily influenced by Ray Bradbury. Again, his short work, I absolutely loved it. J.D. Salinger, on and on. There was a wide variety of work through there. I remember, as I got into high school, I read a lot of Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer. I may have only read them because I used to see them argue on the old Dick Cavett show late at night, but I was fascinated by their work too, and I found myself reading across a wide variety of work. And then I also, at the time, the fact was, since I was writing these short stories and submitting them, and by the way, getting them rejected, I was reading a lot of the mystery and science fiction digest monthly magazines that used to be published, just to see what other short story writers were doing.
Oh, those were great.
And how they were doing it.
Exactly. Those publications in those days were absolutely fantastic to encourage. And they did buy so many short stories. I know, of course, Lawrence Block was part of that whole generation of people who encouraged authors to write short stories. About when you became a Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster, what was that like? I mean, you, it was the same year that Carolyn Hart became Grandmaster.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about that, and because she was my third guest on Joy on Paper when I started this 7 years ago.
I love Carolyn. She's a wonderful lady and a fantastic writer. We've been friends since literally the beginning of my novel career. When I got the phone call from the Mystery Writers of America to tell me that I had been selected to receive the Grand Master Award, I was simply shocked and to say speechless. I know it's cliche, but I really was. I was so unprepared for that honor. I had no expectation of it. I had no warning that that was going to become. But I was terribly, terribly moved. You know, I've devoted my life to writing crime fiction, and to be recognized in that way moved me in a way that I would not have guessed possible. And to this day, it moves me. I'm just terribly, terribly honored by the award.
Well, you know, you created characters that live on. They become a part of the reader. We never forget them. They are, it's just somehow you can always tell a great writer when they get a character that they bring to life in the way that you do and that stays with us really forever.
Well, that's the goal. That's the goal, Patsy. I mean, I think of myself as a character writer. I always have. Character to me comes first. Story. I pride myself on twisty, turny, surprising plots, and all those other elements of my novels. But without a character, without a living character, without a character who comes to life and touches the reader, the rest of it is so much less important than that. Character really is the star of the show.
And, you know, when I think of your book, when I'm going to think of Racing the Light, it will be, one phrase will come to mind, don't tell anyone unless you tell everyone. And that so encapsulates the idea of this book, that Josh isn't believed. And this is so important, this whole thread that runs through the book, that don't tell anyone unless you tell everyone.
Which is what, Josh accepts as his mission. And like I said, I fell in love with Josh because he's a warrior for justice, and he will literally risk everything in order to tell everyone.
Well, I'm so thrilled that you got, the pandemic did things to writers. Some did write. Some actually found that they couldn't write. But you just turned this idea into a real winner. I know everybody was looking forward to it. And it's going to be a bestseller. But I also want to remind my listeners, particularly the ones of you who are writing right now, when you write, if you can just read Robert Crace, because he does it all the time. It's not just in this book. He can, in maybe one page or two pages, he takes you to a place. He puts you in a location. He writes, they're really simple, a few words put together. A school of cars. Or what's the other one I loved? Bathed in a nuclear light. No, bathed in a nuclear glow. I mean, that's so evocative. It's beautiful. You just are a master of words.
Thank you, Patsy.
You really, people who are learning to write or trying to improve their writing or really on their way, they need to read you, because not that many authors can have that preciseness of words that you have, and it's just beautiful, Bob.
Well, it's like the detective would say, Patsy, words are my business.
that's a perfect ending for this wonderful interview. I've been so looking forward to talking to you because, you know, if everybody was looking forward to the book in 2022, I was looking forward to having the opportunity to talk to you again because you are just a fantastic author. And again, Robert Crace, the name of the book is Racing the Light, and it's available online and in every bookstore, I'm sure, because everybody wants it. And you've been translated into how many languages?
Oh, I think it's certainly over 40 now.
Over 40.
So it's well over 40. I've lost count.
I think it's closer to 60. And because you are a global best-selling author, and as Lee Child, you know, Lee Child was here last Thursday for his birthday interview. He comes for a birthday interview every year. And I know that he thinks you are the number one, really, in the whole business.
Oh, that's very kind. I mean, I love Lee, and I've been a reacher creature since his first novel. I'm a big fan of his work.
Okay, well, thank you again, Bob. It was wonderful to talk to you. I have to say bye-bye now. Okay, bye.
Bye.
All right. We'll have some commercials, and then I'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. And I am back with my next guest. Oh, this is so much fun. She's driving me to drink, and I love it. I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Jillian Harvey. And the name of her new book is A Year at the French Farmhouse, Escape to France for the perfect, brand new, uplifting, feel-good book. Yes. Hi, Jillian. Bonjour.
Hello, hi. Bonjour, how are you?
Okay. Oh, well, whenever I read you, I do get this urge to have a glass of wine or two. Which, and a chocolate croissant, I must say. So, but we have discovered from reading this book that a few glasses of wine can get you in deep trouble.
It certainly can, yes.
Oh, you must have had fun writing this book. This is delightful.
Oh, thank you.
So, what do you want to tell us about it? Because this is sort of like, what's the single woman version of French Fields, that English, wonderful English comedy. I love it, and I love the book. So tell us, what happened? What happens to poor Lily Butterworth?
I've been living in France for 12 years now, and I wanted to set a book in France, but I was kind of waiting for the right idea. I didn't want to just put one here for the sake of it, if that made sense. And I just had this sudden flash of inspiration. What would happen if you did something impulsive? The most impulsive thing I could think of when it came to sort of finding yourself in France was to buy a house on eBay. What would happen if you did that? And then taking it a bit further, what would happen if you did it by accident without really meaning to, which is what happens to my main character in the book. And she's sort of fed up, had a few drinks, and decides to just scroll through for some holidays and ends up getting more than she bargained for. But I suppose part of it is the kind of the little mistakes we've all probably made when shopping online, not reading the small print, finding something is not quite what we expected it to be, but just on a huge scale for her.
Really, really big, huge scale.
Yes, just a bit.
a little bit, you know, £43,000. It's so funny. The whole story is so funny. And, of course, it starts off, it starts off that with a redundancy. Now, I love that word. It's so much, somehow it seems so much kinder than the American version, you're fired. One feels one, I don't know, somehow one might just look at that word and think, well, you know, it's not so bad, redundancy. And, you know, and it worked for Lee Child, as you know. He was made redundant at the age of 39 when he was working for Granada Television, and they made him redundant. And as you know, it wasn't the end of the world. He decided to write a book in which he used the names of all of the people who fired him and then bashed their heads against cars.
Excellent idea.
Excellent. And it worked out very well for him.
Yes, certainly did.
So, but have you ever been made redundant? Do you have that personal feeling of what it's like to be made redundant?
No, I haven't. Not so far, anyway. But I have sort of seen it happen to people, and also I've also got to this sort of the age where, as a woman, you sometimes feel a little bit sidelined. And I think it's a combination of those things that Lily feels when she's made redundant. She suddenly feels like surplus to requirements, not really needed, and it's a time of life that she's in. She's just in her sort of coming up for her mid-40s, where she's feeling a little bit sidelined and wondering what the point of everything is. And it's all that culmination of all those things together. I think the idea of being redundant, as in not needed anymore, is quite offensive as well for her, because from her point of view, at least, she's done a lot for this company and not really been recognised for it, and really hung on really out of a sense of loyalty, and then found out that there was no loyalty the other way. So it's that kind of, it's a really big blow for her right at the beginning of the book, and it really sort of knocks her for six.
And but as we discover, it leads to some wonderful things for her too. I have never been made redundant, because I've always been the boss. I've always owned the companies that I, I've created. But I have actually made people redundant. And over the years, you know, looking back on it, I always try to do it very kindly, although a few times not so kindly. And I've wondered if they made something great out of their lives after I made them redundant.
Yes, that's it. I mean, it can be, I think, sometimes, I mean, we're all afraid of that sort of thing, that kind of curveball that life deals with sometimes, whether it's redundancy or something else. And it's I guess that's how we manage that in the moment, and the opportunities that come our way. Giving life a good shake-up can sometimes work out really well, can't it? And I think, I mean, I do work for a few women's magazines, and I've been writing about women from who age about sort of 35 to 90 and beyond, really, for years. And it's always amazed me the kind of resourcefulness that people and the wonderful things that, that some of them do. And really always to defy this stereotype that is around sometimes about women and about men, I think, when you reach middle age and beyond. And I suppose it's that sort of seizing the day. You know, you can lie down and cry, or you can turn everything around and really grab life and think, right, this is an opportunity. It doesn't have to be the end of the road. It's the beginning of a new road. And it's that sort of positive spirit that, that I think Lily eventually taps into after a few glasses of wine, at least.
Exactly. And of course, we have the fun, the absolute fun. And it is this plot line that I love always when someone has to refurbish a house or a hotel they inherit or something like that. Mm. I love this whole refurbishing business. Because I went through it, I did buy, and actually I did buy, not on an impulse because I planned it, but I did buy when I was 21 years old, a 400-year-old cottage, and discovered that it had wet rot and dry rot. And
oh, no.
That was in Sonning, Sonning just outside of Henley. So I know that feeling of having everything ripped apart. So tell us about this process. Did you go through that when you moved to France? Did you have to do refurbishing?
Well, I think everyone that I know who's moved over here from somewhere else, who hasn't sort of started off in France, has had an experience along these lines somewhere along the way. And I don't know anyone who's finished their house. And I think we started off, we did have not quite as dilapidated as the house that Lily buys in the novel, but we had a house that was stone and old and had been done up a bit, but we found that every job had another job underneath. So yeah, you rip off the wallpaper and think you're making things better, only to realize that you probably should have just left it there. and that, and experiences of friends and things. And I think you learn, because when you first come over here, you think, why are all the French people buying all the modern houses, these sort of identikit houses, when there's such beautiful stone houses on the market? And then you find out when you buy one. That said, I think there's a lot, you know, they can be absolutely beautiful, obviously, when they are done properly. It's just, it's something to really, it's a learning curve, I think. Each house is individual in its own way and has its plus points and minus points. And I think, there's lots of war stories around that I've overheard over the years where people have bitten off more than they can chew when it comes to what they've bought. So it's one of those things, isn't it, that, again, things that go wrong in life, as long as they're not too terrible, turn out to be great anecdotes later on. And so that sort of idea that humour can come from these disastrous situations, I've really tried to harness that with her renovations.
Much like Peter Mall did with A Year in Provence. I love his books. I love his writing. And, you know, over the years, as you read it, and then later on when they did the television series, which was so fabulous. As a matter of fact, I was thinking of that when I read your book. I was thinking, oh, this would be a delightful television show. Because people love this kind of story.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's an adventure, isn't it? I suppose it's that idea of sort of what would happen. Because I think, I mean, my husband and I, when we moved over here, we didn't do it in a drunken stupor on eBay, but it was quite impulsive. And it was more of a, let's just do something different. We were under a lot of pressure in our jobs, and there's a lot of general pressure around, and we just thought, we don't actually have to live this life. We can live any life we want. And it was that moment. I think it was just because we had a perfect storm of stress and financial pressures and things like that, and we just kind of sidestepped into this whole different life. And I think it is the kind of thing you think you might do one day and maybe never get round to. And we're not really the sort of people who you would expect to do what we did, but it worked out well for us. And I think once you've done that, or you've watched someone do that, you realise that there are no real rules for how our lives should go and where we should live and what we should do. And it's just opening up that possibility. And this is just one of those possibilities that people have, that you could sort of totally reinvent yourself in a new country if you wanted to, which obviously is what happens.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book. Really,
thank you.
It's one of these books that you sit back and you read and you just sort of melt into it. You just, oh yes, I'm here. Oh. I'm just so relaxed, and it helps if you have a glass of wine. But it's just so relaxed and a lovely, lovely. Yeah. You know, for me, it was just such a pleasure. And this is the kind of book that, you know, people need these books. They need, you know, it's not, you know, they have a lot of romance books. They have a lot of cozy mystery books. But when I read it, I was just happy that there wasn't a lot of other things. Just this sort of life of learning, of what she's going to discover on this new part of her life. There was this unfolding of the story. I enjoyed it so much.
Mm. Oh, well, thank you. That's really lovely to say.
Well, and you're a lovely writer. You have you're very, very
thank
good.
You.
Of course, as you said, you're a journalist, so you've done a lot of work. Were you planning to be a writer when you were in school?
When I was sort of in my early years at school, I wanted to be a writer. That's all I ever really wanted to do. But I think various kind of careers advisors and teachers over the years, they try to manage your expectations a bit. And in the end, I felt really that would never happen for me. So just because it's the sort of thing that happens to other people, isn't it, being an author and that sort of thing. So I started off as an English teacher, and then it was moving to France that really gave me the time to work on my writing, and that's when I started to do freelance and that sort of thing there. So it has been a completely different life for me over here as well.
But so this gave you a sound background, though, in writing, in reading good books. What type of books were the most influential to you when you were, studying?
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, because obviously certainly on the degree I did, you do read a lot of classics, and you read a lot of quite hard-hitting texts, like Pat Barker's Regeneration Trilogy was one of my favourites when I was studying. But then when I finished studying, and I found it hard to read for a little while because I just wanted to analyse everything. I couldn't just be there in the book and enjoy it for what it was. It took me a while to kind of reset. And when I did, I picked up Tony Parsons' Man and Boy, and I found that this is almost a different genre for me because it had that quality writing there, but it was also funny and it had pathos, and it was just really, it was such a warmly written book, and that's really, he sort of inspired me. David Nichols, Helen Fielding, Sue Townsend, all those kind of, there's humour there, there's lightness, there's reality, and that's the kind of writing I really aspired to. So although my English degree and gave me a good background in reading and understanding how text works and that sort of thing, it was really afterwards that I found the kind of writer I really wanted to be, I think. So slightly less Dickens and a little bit more Tony Parsons, I think.
When it's, well, it's coming up to December, do you... Mm. Read the Christmas Carol every year?
No, but I definitely watch it. I usually watch it, and I have read it, obviously. But now I've got my kids, we tend to watch the Muppet version, which actually, you know, it's I never thought I'd well up to watching something with the Muppets in, but it's quite touching adaptation of it. So we do enjoy that every Christmas.
When you were in school and studying, were you more Charlotte Bronte enthusiast, Jane Austen? Because for me, it was Jane Austen, which is why I moved to England. I wanted to live near where she was born.
Oh, yes. Actually, for me, Jane Austen as well, and particularly Pride and Prejudice, which is probably one of the few books I've read more than four or five times. I just used to, whenever I ran out of books, and I think, you know, when I was growing up, obviously, you couldn't just quickly put another one on your Kindle. You had to put time aside to go to the bookshop. So you'd go back to your old favourites, and definitely Pride and Prejudice. I just really enjoyed that. And again, there's that sort of observational humour there, isn't there, which... And you pick up something different every time you read it. So, yeah, definitely an Austen leaning reader.
That's great. Well, I think the new book is just wonderful. And it's called A Year at the French Farmhouse. And it is an escape to France, and literally an escape, because you feel that you're there. I was reading it, and after a while I sort of looked around myself and I think, where am I headed to France? And really was so lovely. So people can get it. It's online.
Thank you.
You know, where I'm sure a lot of bookstores nowadays. And what's your website and your social media so people can follow you?
Okay. So the website is gillianharvey.com, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Jill+5.
Okay, and it's spelled with a G, Gillian.
That's right, yeah.
Gillian Harvey. I love it.
That's it, yeah.
Proper way to do it. And so tell me, is your French, how good is your French? Can you pass for a French woman, or you still have a British accent?
Oh, no. I find it hard to shake the accent. It's getting better. Although I always like to think, because when I hear French people talking English, they have really lovely accent, and I think, well, maybe my accent sounds nice to them when I speak French. So that's what I'm clinging on to.
Yeah,
my French is okay.
I don't think it does. I really don't think they don't appreciate our accents. I don't know,
and
it's really not fair because we love their accents, right? But they don't like our accents.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, we really do.
I don't know.
It's such a shame.
It is.
But it's quite a precise language, isn't it, French? And I think, you know, you have to really get the pronunciation right to be understood. But I'll never be as good as I want to be at French, because I think every time I get to one level, I realise there's a whole other level that I want to be at, and it sort of unravels in front of me. But I keep working at it anyway.
But I bet your kids have a great French accent.
They are amazing. They just they speak English with an English accent and French with a French accent. So they really do have the best of both worlds.
Oh, well,
it's always amazing when they've got friends around and they're gabbling away, and you just think, wow, it's just incredible, isn't it? What the brain can do at a young age. It's just amazing.
Exactly. Well, Gillian Harvey, I think you're wonderful. You're delightful, and I want people to get your book and just have a wonderful, wonderful day. Just reading this book, it's like, it is like going into another world. Again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. I think you're terrific, a wonderful writer. And it was just fun. It's just fun to talk to you.
Thank you. And you too. I appreciate you having me on. It's been lovely.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Okay. Gillian Harvey. What is so nice about this book? As I said, it's not heavy into anything. And that's what when I was reading, I was thinking, it's just not heavy into anything. I didn't have to think about clues. I didn't have to think about romance, really. There's all these elements. I didn't have to think about blood and guts. I've been getting a lot of very bloody books lately. I'm not English bloody kind of books, you know, books with a lot of gore and stuff. I've got to really control the publicists who are sending me these books, because perhaps it's something that happened during the pandemic. Anyway, I want to highly recommend this book. It's really wonderful. A Year at the French Farmhouse. and it will give you a day at the French farmhouse, because you won't put it down. I'm telling you, you'll read it in a day. It's a delightful book. And I just want to tell everybody, oh, wow. I was so happy to have Lee Child and Andrew Grant on the program last week to talk about the newest Jack Reacher, which I understand that they just are starting the filming this week of the new series, which is always exciting. And they have, of course, the wonderful actor who's playing Jack Reacher. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me to hear some more about their life in England. And I want to just thank them so much. And Andrew is going to be back with his wife, Tasha Alexander. They're going to come in sometime in December, and we're going to be talking about British novels. So we're going to have an entire hour about British novels, and they will be here, and we will go through that. And we're each going to select a book, one British novel, and so we'll talk about three British novels and what they mean to us, and a little bit of background into how we started reading these books, why we read them. And so I'm looking forward to Andrew Grant. It's always I get, you know, with that name, but it's Andrew Grant, and Tasha Alexander will be here. And again, I want to thank last week, I want to thank Carol J. Perry. She was here for her Carol J. Perry Day, and I want to thank her publicist and her editor for calling in, and I want to thank Big Ed for handling all the calls that were coming in, and that was wonderful. And I'm so very happy that Carol J. Perry is a good friend to Joy on Paper, and that we had this opportunity to give her a very special day, because her new book, High Spirits, was released last Tuesday, a week ago. It is a wonderful, wonderful Christmas-themed book, and it is just so much fun, and it is set here, right here in our area here in Florida, and you will love it. It's a great book, so you can get it now. It's online. And she's been getting a lot of publicity for that book, because it is a very, very good book. And it's just wonderful how so many magazines have picked up stories about her and are featuring her book, because, she's a great writer. And, that's the wonderful thing about having a great writer. They keep going and they keep getting better, because Carol J. Perry keeps getting better all the time. So please get that. And go to my website. I've got a few things coming up that I think you'll find interesting. And that's www.radio-joyonpaper.com. Meanwhile, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. And your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. Okay, everybody, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed. I already said something nice, and I'll say something again, and he saluted me, because I needed that salute, because I should have been a general. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye.